Welcome to Suffolk Matters, where all of Suffolk County meets the men and women of Suffolk AME. News, opinions, and insights you won't hear anywhere else. Here's your host, the president of New York's largest independent union, Suffolk AME's Dan Levler.
Welcome to another edition of Suffolk Matters on Walk 97.5 and 94.3 The Shark, where Suffolk County meets the men and women of Suffolk AME. News and views you can't hear anywhere else.
So my guest this morning is Pat Cullen. He's the president of the New York State Supreme Court Officers Association. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Dan. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, glad to have you. You know, I think, you know, there's a number of issues for us to talk about. But, you know, first and foremost, just for our listeners, let's get into some background. What motivated you to become a court officer? And then what motivated you to become president for the union that represents court officers?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I actually worked in the private sector in finance for a number of years. And, you know, kind of in line with what I think we're going to, you know, kind of focus a conversation on here today. Sure. Came up, you know, the security of working in the public sector became a factor in the late 90s in finance. You know, there was a big boom, and we were waiting for the other shoe to drop, so to speak. And, you know, the safety and security for my long-term future became a big factor for me. And you know, I sought out employment in the public sector, and court job really was the one that resonated with me the most, and I took it. And then, you know, many years later, after a couple of promotions and learning a lot, not just about public sector employment, but about people.
Sure.
You know, I got involved as a union delegate. And then our union was really in need of a transition. And, you know, I felt that I had the skill set to get involved. And, you know, we formulated a team and ran. And now we're here. You know, not three terms later, and you know, we're moving forward. We're trying to progress every day. We're trying to learn more about the younger members coming in, and while also catering to, you know, the veterans, and, you know, really striking the difference between almost like I feel like we're in a generational change in public employment.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, you know? I feel that. Yep.
And so I think you know, my experience and relative youth still is
right.
Important to kind of meet the challenge on both ends of that spectrum. But yes, I mean, you know, I was raised with the idea, Dan, that, you know, don't be passive about something that means something to you. Be active. And when I saw that our organization needed a clearer picture of leadership, I decided to get involved at a much higher level. And we've been, you know, successful three terms and moving forward.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you know, I found for myself, you know, being a union member, you know, had a certain perspective, then getting active in the union, realizing, hey, things are different than what I thought. And then, you know, now becoming president of this organization, the perch that you sit on, so to speak, the types of conversations you have, the people that you're interacting with, it changes your perspective so much. I mean, you find the same thing, you know, now, you know, again, as a court officer, you were doing the court officer job. Now you're dealing directly with, you know, top administration on issues of safety. And, you know, obviously COVID had to be, you know, I mean, I knew I had countless conversations regarding COVID and everything else, but
right.
That level of advocacy kind of changes your perspective.
Definitely. I think, you know, we're in a small fraternity, even in a union state like New York, where so many people are active union members and care about their employment. We're in a small, you know, a small fraternity of union presidents here. And you know, the way you're right, we receive information and we try to gain information from both sides. And so you don't realize the kind of the passion from the membership and the, you know, the steadfast nature of administration, and those things clash, and, you know, you're caught in the middle. So it's really, it's a matter of kind of trying to rotate your perspective from the membership and understanding that, you know, certain things are difficult to do when it comes to change and management. So, you know, I think the thing you have to really have most of his patients.
Yeah, you know, and there was a, you know, kind of a misnomer passed along to me at one point in time. You know, we had settled a contract and it was going to be for a longer period of time. And, you know, offhand, and I don't think with any malice, someone's like, well, what's left for you to do? And I'm like, negotiations don't end when a contract's in place. No. You are constantly negotiating that contract. And I think nothing could put that further in perspective than COVID. And I'd have to imagine, you know, with the court system and what had to go on with the court system, you had to be negotiating all over the place, you know, safety issues, who's working, who's not working, you know, like, you know.
Yeah, it was, it's been difficult. And I think one of the things that you realize, and like, you're 100% right. It's and again, ever evolving, at our union, we're always looking to create new platforms. When we were first elected, you know, we basically had a ragtag, database. Now we have every platform available, that you can imagine technologically to communicate with our members. So if we don't get you via email, we get you via Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, even email blast, text blast, all of that stuff. And so the level of engagement on the communication end is huge. But
yes,
COVID completely threw a wrench in that, like it did many things.
Yeah.
But our ability, especially in the first few months of the pandemic, to communicate to our members became a little more difficult because a lot of our courts were closed or closed to the public. And so a lot of people were working off-site and things like that. At the end of the day, it became difficult to communicate with people because of that, but also because the information was sketchy at best and it was changing all the time. I mean, it's still changing, right?
Sure.
We're talking about COVID-related things a year, you know, 13 months later, and there's still so much uncertainty about what is it? What are the vaccines? What are the travel requirements?
What's the safe distance that you can stay away from somebody? You know, and I just saw the other day, speaking of, like, you know, we had very rapid changes in the beginning, but even now it's been drilled in our heads, 6 feet away, 10 minutes or more, like all of that. And, 2 days ago, you know, 2 weeks ago, at this point, I can't even remember, 3 feet away is perfectly fine for school children.
Right, right. The stuff about even, you know, being susceptible via surfaces and things like that. So the ever-evolving nature of the news.
Right. I'm not even making a point of, like, you know, should we trust, you know, when the information changes, should we trust it or should we not? Like, that's not even a factor. It, to me, to some extent, it has to do with, you know, just learning new things and being able to understand that, okay, you know, we thought this was the number. We played it safe. It turns out it's this other number. The right. Surfaces, like you were talking about, you know, yeah, there was so many things. But it becomes confusing, obviously, to the public, but, you know, for members and their working conditions and what's safe. Can I go into this building?
Yes, right. And the anxiety and fear, you know, that existed a year ago and, you know, persist to this day, but people acting on rumor or things they heard on social media about COVID, you know, conspiracies and all the like, you know, that fell on the union, and continues to. And so it's really difficult to become, you know, to get all the proper information to answer all the questions that still exist. It's still, you know, kind of a very, it's like a machine.
We're
putting information in. We're trying to get the right information out.
Yep.
Pass that along. And even in that process, information could change. So, you know, it's daunting.
Yeah, and I'm sure you deal with the same thing. You know, we do sometimes, like a member will reach out and they'll disagree with something, or they have heard a rumor regarding, you know, COVID or whatever else. And you know, we'll respond back and say, listen, the federal government, CDC, issued this guidance. This is what the, you know. And they're like, well, you need to get them to change that. And it's like, we are a Suffolk County union looking at our collective bargaining agreement in Suffolk County. And yes, I have no problem having people here reach out and raise that concern for you. But, you know, that's going to get lost in the din of all the other people doing the same thing. And, you know, so you want to do a good job. You want to keep people informed. The information keeps changing. And then at what point in time are you perceived as just part of the machine that's changing the information? You know, like we always try to update people like, hey, listen, this is new guidance, or, you know, the state health department, Department of Health Services says do this.
Right.
Or CDC says do that or whatever else. But, you know.
Well, I think this brings, you know, to light what are we going now to do, you know, as we see the light at the end of the tunnel and restrictions are really, you know, being loosened. And you can really feel like, okay, we are on the verge of getting back to some type of normalcy,
right.
Some real type of normalcy. It's going to fall on the unions now.
Yep.
All unions throughout the state. No matter who you work for, to kind of work together to figure out what are we going to do the next time this happens? Because if you listen to experts, it's an inevitability.
Yeah.
And we sure as hell hope that it's not as bad and that we are more prepared, because it won't be as bad if we are more prepared.
Correct.
And so nobody's going to just come along and go, well, we're working on, you know, we can't leave it to bureaucrats to figure this out.
Right.
We have to be the cog in the machine that makes this happen.
Yes.
And I think through some of the groups that we, that you and I engage in with commonality, should be focused on this type of thing going forward on the statewide level.
I agree. You know, the bureaucrats in general deal with the fire that's in front of them, right? And although they know, you know, there is a pending much bigger fire, they're just worried about that. And, you know, so there is an advantage to unions sitting down and saying, listen, we know this still needs to be worked on, and we're going to dedicate some time to working on this issue. So
right.
Speaking of working on issues,
yeah.
And getting into, like, you know, some of your former life history, you know, and your you know, financial background.
Yeah.
You know, we've worked on other pension related issues before. There was a plan to force legislation at one point in time to make the comptroller of the state of New York invest in ways that the legislature thought was best and not act as sole fiduciary. You know, that whole idea of being a fiduciary, everything you do is to maximize returns for the money that you're sitting on to benefit the population you're sitting on that money for. And you know, it was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of, you know, different articles written, conversations were had. I know that you and I have spoken about this on the airwaves before. And ultimately we were successful. But now, you know, now we're seeing this new push for the Security and Exchange Commission to loosen restrictions on basically like how people can invest their money or how groups should be allowed to invest their money. And it's really the same exact thing. If we're going to change what it means for somebody who is supposed to, as their sole purpose and their legal definition of their sole purpose, is to maximize returns for their clients, and change that to the morality of the folks that are in charge of certain things now, and, you know, those folks could change, and so could those moralities and everything. You know, like, I think we're really opening a Pandora's box here that's not in the best interest of the common people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to unpack, Dan, and I equate it in a way to to a couple of things that have happened, not just in the, you know, the last, let's say, year or 2 years, but going back now, to the origination of a coalition that, you know, we both belong to with our groups both belong to when the Constitutional Convention became an issue.
Right.
And union leadership gathered around the issue and we tamped it down because we made our members aware of the dangers of the Constitutional Convention. And then you fast forward a year or two to the whole, and not that we had much of a fight, but the United States Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME.
Sure.
And the following cases in educating our members, as much as they care to be educated about it, that there is a serious anti-labor sentiment out there, and it's being fought at the state level with the convention, with the United States Supreme Court and Janus, and really cutting at the heart of union organization. And now, you know, these types of, you know, they're attacks, Dan. They're attacks on our retirements. And so
sure.
the at the state level, there was legislation on the table. And we were asked, you know, to be involved. And as much, again, as much as union members, no matter what your job is in New York, wanted to be educated about it, we tried to get as much information out there as possible. It's not the most exciting topic, right? It's not, you know, it's not a union rally, and it's not something that's going to be, you know, on the top of the evening news.
Right.
But it's as important as anything that any of the unions, big,
sure.
small, medium, you know, law enforcement, fire, you know, local government can be involved with, because the pension system itself is, you know, is created by employees. And I think that first and foremost, continuing, especially to get younger members, because younger members aren't thinking of their pension.
Right.
To get them to realize that there is a fundamental and planned attack on their pension systems will affect the rest of their lives, their families, and so on and so forth. So number one, education, and being really on top of what is at the heart of what's trying to happen. So in New York State, you know, a deal was struck between the controller and the, I believe, the sponsors of the bill in Albany to kind of compromise, which, you know, I understand seriousness of climate change and, you know, what causes it and, you know, big corporations and things of that nature being, you know, responsible. But at the end of the day, and I know that this is a cliche, but at the end of the day, the only thing that matters when the pension system is maximizing the return of investment. And that investment is made by us. There can be no other way to say it.
Right.
It's a straightforward fact. It's our investment, our future, and the maximization of that return on investment is absolutely paramount.
Yeah, you know, and again, there's a lot to unpack there. For my listeners, just a reminder, Pat Conlon is our guest this morning. He's the president of the New York State Supreme Court Officers Association. And, you know, all of what we're talking about now, you know, history notwithstanding, but there's a current new debate, you know, a pension debate over proxy regulations. You know, I did an op-ed piece for the chief leader regarding that. But before we dive into proxy regulations, just to unpack the concept, you know, organized labor fought hard to preserve defined pensions. There were points in time where, you know, various forces in management were trying to push public employees to 401k plans. We've seen what's happened in states that has happened in, and the fallout from that. And organized labor, you know, at times, you know, took pay cuts, took responsibility increases, and various other things over the years to preserve this defined benefit. And what we're talking about is, for some people, and, you know, again, you raise the point of, you know, for members that are maybe, you know, younger and just starting out, we're talking about something that would not immediately catch them as flashy, but would absolutely impact the quality of the second half of their life. When they retire and investment returns didn't meet projected goals because limitations were put on what you can and can't invest in.
Right.
Again, based on the morality of, you know, elected people and appointed people that feel this way now, and the issue of the day may change. I feel like, you know, again, we're always talking about this as a Pandora's box. When it's opened, everything's coming out. And the next thing you know, you're going to, you know, not only can you not invest in something that has anything to do with the fossil fuel industry, but
right.
you must invest in this window company that, you know, my cousin happens to own. Right. Like, you know, yeah. I mean, and that's me making an extreme example. Obviously, there's ethical concerns with that, but it still remains that Pandora's box. Let me just say that, you know, there is this public contract, right? You know, when you become a public employee, you're working for the public, and in exchange for working for the public, you get some money, you get some benefits. And one of those benefits is that security at the later point in your life. You can go into the private sector and make quite a bit of money. Maybe you'll have less security during the time you're working in the private sector. And then, you know, maybe you do well on your own in terms of how you invest and how you structure your life or not. Public employees go in knowing that they're going to make a little bit less, but they'll have security on the job. And at the end of their employment, that there will be this little bit of money to sustain them throughout the years. And again, the average, you know, I think a lot of people think that average amount is like $160,000 a year, $200,000 a year, and all this. You know, the real payout is like somewhere in the area of around $30,000, and it's really just based on a percentage of the average public employee's wages.
Right.
And investment gains, right? And so this whole thing exists because a little bit of money goes in for investing purposes, and it sits throughout the career of an employee's time working for the public, and then it pays out later at a rate that it does because the investments grew. And if we start changing what we're allowed to invest in, what we're not allowed to invest in, who the people in charge of, you know, setting those regulations determine, you know, are sound or not sound investments, and not leaving that up to, you know, the proxies themselves, we're going to hemorrhage money. And that's, you know, again, for your younger members, that's going to hurt the most. But I think your older members, just like my older members, are going to be the ones that freak out most immediately.
When it comes to the public perception of pensions, oftentimes the anti-pension sentiment is really just comes from those who don't have a public pension.
Right.
You're 100% right. It's not the amount of money that people get, you know, monthly in a pension. It's the consistency of the money that comes. It's counting on something to continue to pay your mortgage or to, you know, put food on the table after the time that you've contracted with your employer is done. What's also lost is that public pension money is our money. There's this perception that it's not, that it's, you know, completely based on taxpayer money. That's just not a fact.
It's money you didn't get paid.
We deferred that money into this fund for the benefit of it being managed properly, and New York's is as managed as well as anybody right now, for that benefit at you know, on the back end. But you know, it, on you know, social, you know, any pension system cannot be used strictly for political expediency. It's incompatible with the true goal, which is, again, the maximization of return. If you take a group of tens of thousands of people who have taken their hard-earned money and put it into, pension fund, you can't reconcile all of those people's political views, social views, and things of that nature into one consistent package. We're human beings. Everybody sees things differently. We all have different experiences.
Sure.
But to take everybody's funds and money that we put in and have them track on one state of mind or the current trend of politics in Albany, that's just absolutely irresponsible. And that's why, you know, the controller, Tom DiNapoli, has been really a blessing for the state pension fund that my members belong to.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, to capitulate to the issue of the day or the topic of the day is just, you know, completely throwing the concept of the proven concept of the pension system into the fire. And so it's, you know, it's our job, you know, my job, your job,
sure,
all of our brothers and sisters in union representation to be watchdogs when it comes to these types of things. And again, like I said, it's not breaking news on cable news. It's something that you know, happens, unfortunately, I want to say, you know, not behind the, you know, not behind the shadows, but it's not the sexiest topic of conversation. So,
yeah,
it falls on deaf ears sometimes.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. You know, just to reference the op-ed that I had done with the chief leader, you know, I talked about how some members of Congress would like the SEC, Security and Exchange Commission, which regulates financial advisors, to allow activists and extremists to put pressure on investment firms that manage the portfolio of our pension plans and force them to take into consideration environmental, social, and corporate governance issues into account when making investment decisions instead of prioritizing rate of returns. Now,
yeah.
So some people might say, like, oh, no, that's good that, you know, like, you should have, you know, whatever the I don't know, the moral imperative of the day, you know, that should be the factor driving, you know, how pensions are invested. But all investing is done based on the concept of, and that's why I say we'd have to, you know, fundamentally change the legal definition of fiduciary, I think, to allow something like this to happen, because all investments are done with that priority of maximizing returns.
No question. And if you, you know, again, relying on my background in the private sector here, you know, if you just take a look at the market over the last couple of months, it's tenuous at best, because you have e-traders, manipulating stock prices and you know, the bell rings now in the morning, and you don't know if a bunch of teenagers who are able to trade via the internet now are going to cause serious dips and losses and unwarranted spikes in stock prices.
Right.
The idea of a fiduciary.
We saw that with GameStop, right?
GameStop, you know, and Robinhood and that whole thing. And again, it's not interesting to a lot of people, because most. The average American doesn't even understand the stock market. But at the end of the day, having the fiduciary be responsible to the fund members eliminates the connection to this, what amounts to a stock manipulation kind of trend.
Sure.
And, you know, it's a trend just like, something like this TikTok or things like that. It's based on this, like, youth culture, social media platforms and things of that nature, which, you know, is interesting, but it should totally be separate from the investment of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are counting on the returns as they always have. So, yeah, I think, you know, between the political nature nosing its way into our funds and the tenuous nature of how stock market can be manipulated from the corners of the internet,
right.
Those two things are just, you know, they're dangerous.
That's they are, yeah.
Continue to support the fiduciaries who recognize their responsibility to us.
Yeah, you know, and again, you know, the playing around on the stock market, you know, and again, not being something that everybody's so super interested in, but if the system were to break, everyone would feel it. It would affect the economy, and in that way, it affects everyone. And in the same way, you know, when we're talking about these public pensions, if breaking these public pensions, it doesn't just hurt the hardworking men and women involved in this pension system. It also hurts the public, because the public's basically on the hook for the difference, right? Because of the way the laws are structured in New York State, they have to make these payouts, but they couldn't realize the gains they needed to because some SEC regulation on proxy, you know, on these proxies, then made it so you couldn't realize those gains. So now the public is either going to look at a cut in services because the municipalities don't have the ability to provide the services because they're on the hook for this bill that they didn't grow through investment gain, or you're going to see an increase in taxation, right? Those are the two ways to close those holes.
And you can take it even a step further, Dan. You're 100% right on all of those topics. Take it a step further. When it becomes, you know, New York, obviously one of the most expensive states to live in the country. Now, you talk about, you know, increased taxes and more expensive place to live. What you have with pensioners then is they're taking their pension checks to other states, and that money is not being reinvested into the New York state economy. So even a step further, it hurts the general public because we're not returning retiree dollars back into the local economy of the state. And for that reason, the general public suffers as well, because, again, it's in a cyclical way. It winds up negatively affecting the tax base.
I mean, what do pensioners do with their money? They buy food, you know, maybe they fix that fence they were always looking to fix, and, you know, and all of that stuff generates revenue in the economy and also sales tax dollars that go back into the economy and keep this whole system moving. But, Pat, I want to thank you again for joining us. Pat Cullen, president of the New York State Supreme Court Officers Association. This is very important stuff and maybe sometimes a little hard to wrap your head around. I hope we made it as charismatic a topic as possible, but it is of vital importance to everyone. Whether you pay public taxes or you work in the public sector and receive taxpayer funding for your job, this is a vital issue. So, Pat, again, thank you for joining me to talk about this.
Always appreciate you having me on, Dan, and I look forward to working on this topic and many more together in the future.
Absolutely. Okay, and to our listeners, we will speak to you next week.